It's 2018, and if you're not listening to Totally Driven Radio,
you have failed this city.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bear Back Facts. As always, I am your guest, Dallas Duclo, and I am welcoming you all to my show for another edition of history, told, of course, exclusively by myself. Now, for those of you who are just joining us for the first time, this show serves a variety of purposes, the first and foremost being providing a not only informative platform for listeners to learn about some of history's more fascinating individuals, mythology, religion, and various philosophies from all over the world, but it's also a platform which I like to showcase young people from various backgrounds as well, whether they be musicians, artists, and academics. But today, we're going to be going with the original format, which is to talk about individuals who've made tremendous contributions to our history. And today, we're going to be talking specifically about Susan B. Anthony. So I'm glad to have you all here today. This show has covered a variety of very impactful men from around the world. We have done a few women here and there, but this is the first time we really dipped into civil rights and suffrage and those sorts of aspects of history from a feminine standpoint. And so without further ado, let's get right into it. So let's learn a little bit about Susan B. Anthony. Now, Susan B. Anthony was born on February 15th in 1820 in Adams, Massachusetts. She is considered to be a pioneer. Sorry, guys, we have a little technical difficulty there. She's considered to be a pioneer for not only the women's suffrage movement, but also for civil rights early on. She is considered to be one of those first few voices that shouted the loudest for people to finally recognize equality across the board, not just for women, but also people of color, people who have been suppressed throughout history around her. So, this is a pretty impactful individual. So, and I do apologize for some of the technical difficulties we've experienced already today. That's been one of those weeks. But she is best known for the fact that she was an American social reformer and women's rights activist. She played an absolutely pivotal role in the women's suffrage movement. And if you don't know what suffrage is, let's go ahead and dive right into the term. Suffrage refers to the legal right of a person to vote. And when we talk about it in the context of women, many people around the world have a voice in their countries, but it's not always been so. People from different backgrounds, whether they be white, black, Hispanic, Asian, what have you, here in the United States, have all had moments in history where they weren't really given the opportunity to have their voice. In fact, countries who allowed women to vote before we did, India being one of those countries where women were actually put forth as political leaders before we've done it. So there are a number of countries around the world that have done You know, India and Pakistan have both had female presidents, both had female prime ministers and what have you. So they've had people in positions of power that were not men. This is something that was that is quite foreign here in the United States. We do have females in we do have women in the House of Representatives, in Congress, in Senate, but we've yet to have a woman president. That's still something we've never had. But those things wouldn't even be conceivable to talk about here in the United States without the efforts of women such as Susan B. Anthony and people involved in this movement, the suffrage movement here in the United States. So this is the course. This was a movement that took place over the course of several decades, and it first took place in various states and small localities, and mostly on a limited basis because they were trying very, very hard to get people on board with them. Now, the demand for women's suffrage and the movement for women to have the opportunity to vote began to gather strength in the 1840s, and it emerged from the broader movement for women's rights in general. And we're gonna get into this as well in tandem with talking about Susan B. Anthony, because they do tie in very well together, because she's a huge part of this movement. Now, Susan B. Anthony was born into a Quaker family, committed to social equality. She collected anti-slavery petitions at the age of 17, and in 1856, she became the New York State agent for the American Anti-Slavery Society. In 1851, she met Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who became her lifelong friend and co-worker in social reform activities, primarily in the field of women's rights. Now, in 1852, they would found the New York Women's State Temperance Society after Anthony was prevented from speaking at a temperance conference because she was a woman. In 1863, they founded the Women's Loyal National League, which conducted the largest petition drive in United States history up to that time, collecting nearly 400,000 signatures in support of the abolition of slavery. In 1866, together with Elizabeth Stanton, Susan B. Anthony helped to initiate the American Equal Rights Association, which campaigned for equal rights for both women and African Americans. In 1868, they began publishing a women's rights newspaper called The Revolution, and in 1869, they founded the National Women's Suffrage Association as part of a split in the women's movement. Now, in 1890, the split would formally be healed when their organization would merge with the rival American Women's Suffrage Association to form the National American Women's Suffrage Association with Anthony as its key force. In 1876, Anthony and Stanton began working with Matilda Joslyn Gage on what would eventually grow in, which eventually became the six-volume history of women's suffrage, and the interests of Anthony and Stanton would later diverge somewhat in years, but the two remained close friends. Now, to give you an idea of how determined Susan B. Anthony was, we'll get into some of her activities a little bit later, but I do want to return to talking about her early life. I just wanted to list off a few of her massive achievements and some of the major things that she took part in. She was, again, as I said, born to a Quaker family in Adams, Massachusetts. She was the second oldest of seven children, and she was named for her mother's mother, Susanna, and for her father's sister, Susan. In her youth, she and her sisters responded to a great craze for middle initials by adding middle initials to their own names, and Anthony adopted B as her middle name because her namesake, Aunt Susan, had married a man named Brownell. Her family shared a passion for social reform. Her brothers Daniel and Merritt moved to Kansas to support the anti-slavery movement there, and whilst there, her brother Merritt fought with John Brown against pro-slavery forces during the Bleeding Kansas crisis. And for those of you unfamiliar with that, that was a battle in Kansas that took place over whether or not Kansas was going to become a slave state once joining the Union. Now, Daniel eventually owned a newspaper and became mayor of Leavenworth. Susan B. Anthony's sister, Mary, with whom she shared a home in later years, became a public school principal in Rochester and a women's rights activist as well. Anthony's father was an abolitionist and temperance advocate. And if you're not sure what temperance is, I know I've thrown it around, the temperance movement is a movement that took place in the United States that was trying to curb the consumption of alcohol. They had a large impact throughout the early, or throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th century in American politics. They were a very moral group dedicated to cleaning up what they saw as an immoral society, and they saw alcohol as a major influence on creating violence in their society, and they wanted to curb that as much as possible. Now, as a Quaker, Daniel Anthony, her father, Susan B. Anthony's father, had a difficult relationship with his traditionalist congregation, which rebuked him for marrying a non-Quaker and then disowned him for allowing a dance school to operate in his home. He continued to attend Quaker meetings anyway and became even more radical in his beliefs. Susan B. Anthony's mother was a Methodist and helped raise her children in a more tolerant version of her husband's religious tradition. Their father encouraged them all, girls as well as boys, to be self-supporting, teaching them business principles and giving them responsibilities at an early age. So in a household in which she was treated equal to her brothers, it stands to reason that when she's being told about equality, father and mother are both speaking about the importance of taking personal responsibility, supporting yourself. They're teaching them the principles of business, how to manage money, and then giving them responsibilities over their own selves at an early age. It's no wonder Susan B. Anthony becomes as gung-ho for equality and across the board as she does. Now, at the age of six, Susan B. Anthony and her family moved to Battenville, New York, where her father managed a large cotton mill. Now, previously, he had operated his own small cotton factory. At the age of 17, Anthony was sent to a Quaker boarding school in Philadelphia, where she unhappily endured its severe atmosphere. She was forced to end her studies after one term because her family was financially ruined during an economic downturn known as the Panic of 1837. They were forced to sell everything they had at an auction, but they were rescued by her maternal uncle, who bought most of their belongings and restored them to the family. To assist her family financially, Anthony left the home to teach at a Quaker boarding school. Now, in 1845, the family moved to a farm in the outskirts of Rochester, New York, purchased partly with the inheritance of Anthony's mother, and there they associated with a group of Quaker social reformers who had left their congregation because of the restrictions it placed on reform activities, and who in 1848 formed a new organization called the Congressional Friends, or the Congregational Friends, I should say, sorry. The Anthony Farmstead soon became the Sunday afternoon gathering place for local activists, including Frederick Douglass, a former slave and a prominent abolitionist who became Anthony's lifelong friend. Now, as several others in the group were already doing, the Anthony family began to attend services at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester, which was associated at the time with social reform. The Rochester Women's Rights Convention of 1848 was held at that church in 1848, obviously, and inspired by the Seneca Falls Convention, which we'll get to in a little bit. The first Women's Rights Convention, which was held 2 weeks earlier in a town nearby. Now, Anthony's parents and her sister Mary attended the Rochester Convention and signed the Declaration of Sentiments that had first been adopted by the Seneca Falls Convention. So, what was the Seneca Falls Convention before we proceed? This was the first Women's Rights Convention. It advertised itself as a convention to discuss the social, civil, and religious condition and rights of women. It was held in Seneca Falls, New York, and it spanned 2 days. So it lasted from July 19th to July 20th in 1848. It attracted widespread attention and was soon followed by other conventions, not including but not limited to the one we just spoke about, the one in Rochester, and then later spawned in 1850, the first in a series of annual national women's rights conventions met in Worcester, Massachusetts. So this is a big, big deal when it happened because it was the first time that it happened. And at this convention, there was a document signed called the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments, or shortened, the Declaration of Sentiments. It is a document that was signed by 68 women and 32 men, 100 out of some 300 attendees at the first women's rights convention to be organized by women. And ultimately, it was a pretty popular event. Now, at this event, The principal author of the Declaration was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who modeled it upon the United States Declaration of Independence. While she was the key organizer of the convention, along with Lucretia Coffin Mott and Martha Coffin Wright. According to the North Star, published by Frederick Douglass, whose attendance at the convention and support of the Declaration helped pass the resolutions put forward, the document was the grand movement for attaining the civil, social, political, and religious rights of women. At a time when temperance and female property rights were major issues, even many supporters of women's rights believed the Declaration's endorsement of women's suffrage would hinder the nation's rights, women's rights movement, causing it to lose much-needed support. So one of the major things discussed in the document, and how shocking it was that women should have the right to vote. So here are the opening paragraphs of the document to give you an idea of what kind of a document we're looking at. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that which they have hitherto occupied, but one to which the laws of nature and of God's and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to such a course. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among them these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these rights, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it and to insist upon the institution of any new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Now, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. And so, as you can see, this is just, you know, basically an addendum. It is, in fact, modeled after the Declaration of Independence. And here are some of the sentiments placed within. He has not ever permitted her to exercise her inalienable right to the elective franchise. He has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she had no voice. He has withheld from her rights which are given to the most ignorant and degraded men, both natives and foreigners. Having deprived her of this first right as a citizen, the elective franchise, thereby leaving her without representation in the halls of legislation, he has oppressed her on all sides. He has made her, if married, in the eye of the law, civilly dead. He has taken from her all right and property, even to the wages she earns. He has made her morally an irresponsible being, and she can commit many crimes with impunity, provided they can be done in the presence of her husband. In the covenant of marriage, she is compelled to promise obedience to her husband, he becoming to all intents and purposes her master, the law giving him power to deprive her of her liberty and to administer chastisement. He has so framed the laws of divorce as to what shall be the proper causes of divorce in case of separation, to whom the guardianship of the children shall be given, as to be wholly regardless of the happiness of the women, the law in all cases going upon a false supposition of the supremacy of a man and giving all power into his hands. So these are all grievances of women towards their government. These are all a list of grievances. The sentiments are a list of grievances put forth by the women at this convention, the ability to vote, their right to divorce, their right to own property, to have a voice in their legislation, to have someone represent their interests. And this is all taking place at the Seneca Falls Convention. It is further taking place again at the Rochester Women's Convention later in the year. Now, Anthony did not take part in either of these conventions because she had moved to Conajohari in 1846 to be headmistress of the Department of Conajohari Academy. Away from Quaker influences for the first time in her life, at the age of 26, She began to replace her plain clothing with more stylish dresses, and she quit using thee and other forms of speech traditionally used by Quakers. She was interested in social reform, and she was distressed at being paid much less than men with similar jobs to her. But she was amused at her father's enthusiasm over the Rochester Women's Rights Convention. She later explained that I wasn't ready to vote, didn't want to vote, but I did want equal pay for equal work. When the Conajohari Academy closed in 1849, Anthony took over the operation of the family farm in Rochester so her father could devote more time to his insurance business. She worked at this task for a couple of years, but found herself increasingly drawn to reform activity. With her parents' support, she was soon fully engaged in reform work, and for the rest of her life, she lived almost entirely on fees she earned as a speaker. Cautious, careful people always casting about to preserve their reputation and social standing can never bring about reform. Those who are really in earnest must be willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly and privately in season and out avow their sympathy with despised and persecuted ideas and their advocates and bear the consequences. This is a quote from Susan B. Anthony from one of her speaking engagements, and this is her view of how people needed to approach these social reforms. You can't just be trendy. In her mind, couldn't just be a little bit trendy. You couldn't just talk about the hot topic. You were either about this life or you were not. Now, Anthony embarked on her career of social reform with energy, vigor, and determination. Schooling herself on issues regarding reform, she found herself drawn to the more radical ideas of people like William Lloyd Garrison, George Thompson, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Soon she was wearing the controversial bloomer dress. My God, she was wearing bloomers. How could this happen? Consisting of pantaloons, one worn under a knee-length dress. Oh, my. Although it was more sensible than the traditional heavy dresses that dragged the ground, she reluctantly quit wearing it after a year because it gave her opponents the opportunity to focus on her apparel rather than her ideas. Now, I mentioned before, it was during when I was listing her achievements, that it was during the year of 1851 that Anthony was introduced to Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And it was at this time that she became more familiar with the Seneca Falls Convention and what Elizabeth Cady Stanton was sort of about. They were introduced by Amelia Bloomer, a feminist and mutual acquaintance who had not signed the Declaration of Sentiments and subsequent resolutions despite her attendance at the convention. Anthony and Stanton soon became close friends and co-workers and formed a relationship that was pivotal for themselves and for the women's movement as a whole. After the Stantons moved from Seneca Falls, New York, to New York City in 1861, a room was set aside for Anthony in every house they lived in. One of Stanton's biographers estimated that over her lifetime, Elizabeth Cady Stanton spent more time with Susan B. Anthony than with any other adult or other human being, including her own husband and children. The two women had complementary skills. Anthony excelled at organizing, while Stanton had an aptitude for intellectual matters and writing. Anthony was dissatisfied with her own writing ability and wrote relatively little for publication. When historians illustrate her thoughts with direct quotes, they usually take them from her speeches, letters, and diary entries. Anthony knew that her skin didn't really lie in writing. She never had a taste for it. But she had a fire for speaking and a fire for organizing people and motivating them to go and hear her speak. Stanton, on the other hand, was never much for speaking, but she could write. She had written the sentiments. She had put together that declaration of sentiments. And soon they became a match made in heaven. Now, because Stanton was homebound with seven children while Anthony was unmarried and free to travel, Anthony assisted Stanton by supervising her children while Stanton wrote. One of Anthony's biographers said that Susan became one of the family and was almost another mother to Mrs. Stanton's children. Now, according to a biography of Stanton, says that during the early years of their relationship, Stanton provided the ideas, rhetoric, and strategies, and Anthony delivered the speeches, circulated the petitions, and rented the halls in which they would put forth their ideas. Now, Anthony prodded and Stanton produced. As Stanton's husband said, Susan stirred the puddings, Elizabeth stirred up Susan, and then Susan stirs up the world. Stanton herself said, I forged the thunderbolts, and she fired him. And this is in reference, of course, to those of you not familiar with Greek mythology, to the relationship between the Cyclops and Zeus. The Cyclops were a race of beings in Greek mythology who forged the very weapon that the god Zeus was famed for throwing, which was a lightning bolt. So in Stanton's mind, she was the Cyclops, the wise craftsman, building, who was providing the weaponry that Susan B. Anthony was going to use to slay their enemy. And their enemy was a system that did not offer them the ability to have a voice, did not offer them the opportunity for representation, and did not give them the opportunity to be successful on the same level of their peers. And put too many roadblocks in their way that allowed them to not fulfill their potential to the fullest extent. Now, by 1854, Anthony and Stanton had perfected a collaboration that made the New York State movement the most sophisticated in the country. The temperance was very much a women's right issue at the time because of the laws that gave husbands complete control of the family and its finances. A woman with a drunken husband had little legal recourse, even if his alcoholism left the family destitute and he was abusive to her and her children. If she obtained a divorce, which was incredibly difficult to do, he could easily end up with guardianship of the children. While teaching at the academy in Canajoharie, Anthony joined the Daughters of Temperance and in 1849 gave her first public speech at one of its meetings. In 1852, she was elected as a delegate to the State Temperance Convention, but was stopped by the chairman when she attempted to speak, saying that women delegates were only there to listen and to learn. They were not there to speak and lecture to men. Anthony and some other women immediately removed themselves from the hall and announced a meeting of their own, which created a committee to organize a women's state convention. Now, largely organized by Anthony, the convention of 500 women met in Rochester in April and created the Women's State Temperance Society, with Stanton as president and Anthony as state agent. Anthony and her co-workers collected 28,000 signatures on a petition for a law to prohibit the sale of alcohol in New York State. She organized a hearing on that law before the New York legislature, the first that had been initiated in that state by a group of women ever. At the organization's convention the following year, however, the conservative members attacked Stanton's advocacy of the right of a wife of an alcoholic to obtain a divorce. And Stanton was voted out as president, whereupon she and Anthony resigned from the organization. Now, in 1853, Anthony attended the World's Temperance Convention in New York City, which bogged down for three chaotic days in a dispute about whether women would be allowed to speak there. Years later, Anthony had observed, no advance taken by women has been so bitterly contested as that of speaking in public. For nothing which they have attempted, not even to secure the suffrage, have they been so abused, condemned, and antagonized. Now, after this period of struggles, that Anthony began focusing her energy on abolitionist and women's rights activities. So she learned early on, as we can see, Susan B. Anthony learned early on that politics were, at least in the eyes of men at the time, a man's game, and that women were not welcome in this world of politics by men. And at the heart, and the heart of her initial foray, and you know, some people would say, well, you know, duh, it's this time period. But the hardest part about this was how ingrained it was in their society. Remember that people that came to the United States, the original colonists came here and founded this country on the premise that there would be an equal, that this would be a new nation. But with them, they still carried their old ideas. Remember that women in England didn't have you know, a lot of these rights either for quite a while. Women in other places that these that many of the immigrants that come to this country have come from didn't have these rights, and that's what they were fighting for when they got here. So you leave one, you leave a country to pursue freedom, and then here you are in a country where you're trying to pursue freedom, and before you lies nothing but roadblocks telling you that you can't have it. And so Susan B. Anthony and her compatriots continued their journey, continued to trumpet loudly the call of the Founding Fathers, saying, you guys don't believe in this. You only believe in it for men. But what about us? We are the ones who create you. We're the ones that allow you. Without us, you wouldn't be here. And so these are a lot of the arguments that are coming up. This is the first real push for women, and she is the spearhead of this movement. Now, when Anthony tried to speak at the New York State Teachers Association meeting in 1853, her attempt sparked a half-hour debate among the men about whether it was proper for women to speak in public. Finally allowed to continue, Anthony said, "Do you not see that so long as society says a woman is incompetent to be a lawyer, a minister, or doctor, but has ample ability to be a teacher, that every man of you who chooses this profession tacitly acknowledges that he has no more brains than a woman?" So let's go back and decode what Anthony said. She says that so long as society says a woman is too incompetent to be a lawyer, a minister, or a doctor, but is competent enough to teach men to do these things, that men are ignorantly acknowledging that they are no smarter than a woman and are undermining their own arguments that women can't do these things. If they can be taught by women to do these trades, it stands to reason that women themselves are capable of doing these trades. At the 1857 Teachers Convention, she introduced a resolution calling for the admission of black people to public schools and colleges, but it was rejected as not a proper subject for discussion. When she introduced another resolution calling for males and females to be educated together at all levels, including colleges, it was ferociously opposed and decisively rejected. One opponent called the idea a vast social evil, the first step in the school which seeks to abolish marriage, and behind this picture, I see a monster of social deformity. Anthony continued to speak at teachers' conventions for several years, insisting that women teachers should receive equal pay with men and serve as officers and committee members within the organization. Anthony's work for the women's rights movement began at a time when that movement was already gathering momentum. Stanton had already helped to organize the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, and in 1850, the first in a series of national women's rights conventions was held in Worcester, Massachusetts. In 1852, Anthony attended her first convention, which was held in Syracuse, New York, where she served as one of the convention's secretaries. According to Ida Husted Harper, Anthony's authorized biographer, Miss Anthony came away from the Syracuse convention thoroughly convinced that the right which women needed above every other, indeed, the one indeed which would secure her to all others, was the right of suffrage. Suffrage, however, did not become the main focus of her work for several more years. Now, a major hindrance to the movement was a lack of money. Few women at that time had an independent source of income, and even those with employment generally were required by law to turn over their pay to their husbands. So you can see where this might be a problem. Partly through the efforts of the women's movement, a law had been passed in New York in 1848 that recognized some rights for married women, but that law was limited. In 1853, Anthony worked with William Henry Channing, her activist Unitarian minister, to organize a convention in Rochester to launch a state campaign for improved property rights for married women, which Anthony would lead. She took her lecture and petition campaign into almost every county in New York during the winter of 1855, despite the difficulty of traveling in snowy terrain in horse and buggy days. When she presented the petitions to New York State Senate Judiciary Committee, its members told her that men were actually the oppressed sex because they did such things as giving women the best seats and carriages. They gave up a good seat in a carriage. Wow. That is tough. Noting cases in which the petition had been signed by both husbands and wives instead of the husband signing for both, which was the standard procedure, the committee's official report sarcastically recommended that the petitioners seek a law authorizing the husbands in such marriages to wear petticoats and the wives' trousers as well. The campaign finally achieved success in 1860 when the legislature passed an improved Married Women's Property Act that gave married women the right to own separate property, enter into contracts, and be joint guardian of their children. The legislature rolled back much of this law in 1862, however, during a period when the women's movement was largely inactive because of the American Civil War. You know, a period of time in which it probably would have been a good thing for women to have more rights over their children and households since their husbands were going off. Said, we're going to take our first quick commercial break here, guys. And it's at this time I want to remind you all that we have a proud new sponsor here, Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. So do check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Susan B. Anthony's activities. Specifically, we're going to address her participation in the movement for abolitionism, and that is her involvement with the anti-slavery movement here in the United States.
Hey, everybody, this is Bay Ragney of Totally Driven Radio, and I'm here to let you know about a person you might know as one of Philly's cheesesteak kings or the TV personality, but I'm letting you know about a good friend of the show's and mine, Mr. Tony Luke Jr. He recently released his own song rendition of the Bob Dylan classic, Make You Feel My Love, which is now available on Apple Music, Spotify, and iTunes. He recorded the song for all individuals who are struggling with addiction and their families. 100% of all the proceeds that are made from this recording is going directly to fund the Brown and White Initiative, #BrownandWhite, to end the stigma associated with addiction. #EndTheStigma, #LoveTheAddict. #Hashtag you are loved. #Hashtag you need something.
When the rain is blowing in your face and the whole world is on your case, I can offer you a warm embrace to make you feel my love.
I'm black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black my beer. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well then, visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our Wacky Stores page on Facebook.
All right, welcome back, everybody. I do hope you enjoyed the commercial break. Now that we're back, let's talk a little bit about more about Susan B. Anthony. Now, where we left off, I talked about how they managed to finally get a law that gave married women the rights over some of their property and their ability to have and the ability to have joint guardianship over their children. But this law was rolled back during the Civil War. The women's movement was loosely structured at the time, with few state organizations and no national organization other than a coordinating committee that arranged annual conventions. Now, one Lucy Stone, who did much of the organizational work for the conventions, encouraged Anthony to take over some of the responsibility for them. Anthony resisted at first, feeling she was needed more in the field of anti-slavery activities, and after organizing a series of anti-slavery meetings in the winter of 1857, she told a friend that the experience of the last winter is worth more to me than all my temperance and women's rights work, though the latter were the school necessary to bring me into the anti-slavery work. During a planning session for the 1858 Women's Rights Convention, Stone, who had recently given birth, told Anthony that her new family responsibilities would prevent her from organizing conventions until her children were older. And so Anthony presided at the convention in 1858, and when the planning committee for the national conventions was reorganized, Stanton became its president and Anthony its secretary. Anthony continued to be heavily involved in anti-slavery work at the same time. So she was an absolute machine. And her interest in anti-slavery started out early. At the age of 16, she had collected petitions against slavery as part of an organized resistance to the newly established gag rule that prohibited anti-slavery petitions in the U.S. House of Representatives. Just going to show you that if you tell somebody to shut up, they're probably going to keep talking about it. Don't talk about it. All right, we're going to talk about it anyway. In 1851, she played a key role in organizing an anti-slavery convention in Rochester. She was also part of the Underground Railroad. An entry in her diary in 1861 read, "Fitted out a fugitive slave for Canada with the help of Harriet Tubman." Is there anything this woman couldn't do? In 1856, Anthony agreed to become the New York State agent for the American Anti-Slavery Society with the understanding that she would also continue her advocacy of women's rights. Anthony organized anti-slavery meetings throughout the state under banners that read, "No compromise with slaveholders. Immediate and unconditional emancipation." Uncompromising. She developed a reputation for fearlessness in facing down attempts to disrupt her meetings, but opposition became overwhelming on the eve of the Civil War. Mobs shut down her meetings in every town from Buffalo to Albany in early 1861. In Rochester, the police had to escort Anthony and other speakers from the building for their own safety. In Syracuse, according to one local newspaper account, rotten eggs were thrown, benches were broken, knives and pistols gleamed in every direction. People were pretty upset about this. Anthony herself expressed a vision of a racially integrated society that was radical for a time when abolitionists were debating the question of what was to become of the slaves. After Anthony, the question had a very simple answer. They would stay. They would be part of our society. And when people like Abraham Lincoln were calling for all African Americans to be shipped to newly established colonies in Africa, in a speech in 1861, Anthony gave us the answer. She said, "Let us open to the colored man all our schools. Let us admit him into all our mechanic shops, stores, offices, and lucrative business avocations. Let him rent such pew in the church and occupy such seat in the theater. Extend to him all the rights of citizenship." keep in mind, this is in 1861. People that are part of the larger abolitionist movement, and even Lincoln, who's not really a big fan of slavery, as you may well know, really isn't. They're not really willing to go this far yet. But Susan B. Anthony is willing to go all the way and say, "This is what we got to do. They're here. Why waste our time sending them somewhere else? They're already here, people right here." Now, the relatively small women's rights movement of that time was closely associated with the American Anti-Slavery Society led by William Lloyd Garrison. And the movement depended heavily on abolitionist resources, with its articles published in their newspapers and some of its funding provided by abolitionists. There was tension between the leaders of the movement for the women's movement and the male abolitionists who, though, although supporters of increased women's rights, believed that a vigorous campaign for women's rights would interfere with their campaign against slavery. Now, in 1860, when Anthony sheltered a woman who had fled an abusive husband, Garrison insisted that the woman give up the child she'd brought with her, pointing out that the law gave husbands complete control of children, to which Anthony reminded Garrison that he had helped slaves escape to Canada in violation of the law, and said, "Well, the law which gives the father ownership of the children is just as wicked, and I'll break it just as quickly." When Stanton introduced a resolution at the National Rights Convention in 1860 favoring more lenient divorce laws, leading abolitionist Wendell Phillips not only opposed it, but attempted to have it removed from the record. When Stanton, Abbott, Anthony, and others supported a bill before the New York legislature that would permit a divorce in cases of desertion or inhumane treatment, Horace Greeley, an abolitionist newspaper publisher, campaigned against it in the pages of his newspaper. Garrison, Phillips, and Greeley all had provided valuable help to the women's movement. In a letter to Lucy Stone, Anthony said, "The men, even the best of them, seem to think the women's rights question should be waived for the present. So let us do our own work and in our own way." Anthony and Stanton organized the Women's Loyal National League in 1863 to campaign for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would abolish slavery. And it was the first national women's political organization in the United States. In the largest petition drive in the U.S. history up to that time, they collected nearly 400,000 signatures to abolish slavery, representing approximately one out of every 24 adults in the northern states. The petition drive significantly assisted the passage of the 13th Amendment, which ultimately would lead to the end of slavery. Anthony was the chief organizer of this effort, which involved recruiting and coordinating some 2,000 petition collectors, provided the women's movement with a vehicle for combining the fight against slavery with the fight for women's rights by reminding the public that petitioning was the only political tool available to women at the time when men were the only ones allowed to vote. Now, with a membership of 5,000, it helped develop a new generation of women leaders, providing experience and recognition for not only Stanton and Anthony, but also newcomers like Anna Dickinson, a gifted teenage orator in her own right. The League demonstrated the value of formal structure to a women's movement that had resisted being anything other than loosely organized up to that point. The widespread network of women activists who assisted the League expanded the pool of talent that was available to reform movements, including the women's suffrage movement after the war. Now, Anthony would later stay with her brother Daniel in Kansas for 8 months in 1865 to assist with his newspaper, after which time she headed back east after she learned that an amendment to the U.S. Constitution had been proposed that would provide citizenship for African Americans, but would also, for the first time, introduce the word male into the Constitution. Anthony supported citizenship for black, any attempt to link it with a reduction in the status of women. Her ally Stanton agreed, saying that if the word male be inserted, it will take us at least a century to get it out. Probably right. Anthony and Stanton worked to revive the women's rights movement, which had become nearly dormant during the Civil War. And in 1866, they organized the 11th National Women's Convention for Women's Rights. the first since the start of the Civil War. Unanimously adopting a resolution introduced by Anthony, the convention voted to transform itself into the American Equal Rights Association, or AERA, whose purpose was to campaign for the right, equal rights of all citizens, especially the right of suffrage. And the leadership of the new organization included such prominent activists as Lucretia Mott, Lucy Stone, and Frederick Douglass. Its drive for universal suffrage, however, was resisted by some abolitionist leaders and their allies in the Republican Party, who wanted the women to postpone their campaign for suffrage until after it had been achieved for male African Americans. Horace Greeley, a prominent newspaper editor, told Anthony and Stanton, "This is a critical period for the Republican Party and the life of our nation. I conjure you to remember that this is the Negro's hour, and your first duty now is to go through the state and plead his claims." Stanton refused to postpone their demands and continued to push for universal suffrage. It's amazing that people were just, these guys were just so blind to not understand that, yes, these women definitely care about ending slavery, but you know what else they care about? Having the ability to vote and having an actual say about slavery, other than, well, it's bad and we really want it to end. We're going to talk about it, but nothing we say is going to really matter because, you know, we don't have a vote. In addition to that, let's not forget, up to this point, you can see all the legwork that Anthony's been doing and Stanton's been putting in a lot of writing here. With all this legwork, you got to figure they'd be a little bit frustrated at this point. And obviously, these guys just didn't get it. In 1867, the AERA campaigned in Kansas for a referenda that would enfranchise both African Americans and women. Wendell Phillips, an abolitionist leader who opposed mixing those two causes, blocked the funding that they had expected, that the AERA expected for their campaign. After an internal struggle, Kansas Republicans decided to support suffrage for black men only and formed an anti-female suffrage committee to oppose the efforts of Stanton's organization. By the end of the summer, the AERA campaign had almost collapsed and its finances were exhausted. Anthony and Stanton created a storm of controversy by accepting help during the last days of the campaign from George Francis Train, a wealthy businessman who supported women's rights. Train antagonized many activists by attacking the Republican Party and openly disparaging the integrity, intelligence of African Americans. There is reason to believe, however, that Anthony and Stanton hoped to draw the volatile Train away from his cruder forms of racism, and that he had actually begun to do so. After the Kansas campaign, the AERA increasingly divided into two wings, both advocating universal suffrage but with different approaches. One wing, whose leading figure was Lucy Stone, was willing for black men to achieve suffrage first and wanted to maintain close ties with the Republican Party and the abolitionist movement. The other, whose leading figures were Anthony and Stanton, insisted that women and black men should both be enfranchised at the same time and work toward a politically independent women's movement that would no longer be dependent on abolitionists. The AERA effectively dissolved after an acrimonious meeting in 1869, and two competing women's suffrage organizations were created in the aftermath. It's at this time that Anthony and Stanton really start to shine again. Anthony and Stanton began publishing a weekly newspaper called The Revolution in New York City in 1868. It focused primarily on women's rights. Surprise, surprise, especially suffrage for women. But it also covered other topics, including politics, the labor movement, and finance. Its motto was, men, their rights and nothing more, women, their rights and nothing less. Well, it's a simple motto. I think it works. One of its goals was to provide a forum in which women could encourage opinions on key issues from a variety of viewpoints. Anthony managed the business aspects of the paper, while Stanton was co-editor along with Parker Pillsbury, an abolitionist and supporter of women's rights. Initial funding was provided by George Francis Train, the controversial businessman who supported women's rights, but alienated many activists with his political and racial views. surprise, surprise. In the aftermath of the Civil War, major periodicals associated with the radical social reform movements had either become more conservative or had quit publishing or soon would. But not on my watch, Anthony said. She intended for the revolution to partially fill that void, hoping to grow it eventually into a daily paper with its own printing press, all owned and operated by women. And damn it, they were going to make it happen. The funding Train had arranged for the newspaper, however, was less than expected. Moreover, Train sailed for England after the revolution published its first issue and was soon jailed for supporting Irish independence. So Anthony and company really struggled after this. For a while, things were looking pretty good, but then Train screwed it up. Train's financial support, of course, eventually disappeared entirely. After 29 months, mounting debts forced Anthony to transfer the paper to Laura Curtis Bullard, a wealthy women's rights activist who gave it a less radical tone. The paper published its last issue less than 2 years later. But despite its short life, the revolution gave Anthony and Stanton a means expressing their views during the developing split within the women's movement, and it also helped them to promote their wing of the movement, which eventually became a separate organization. Now, following the dissolution of the revolution's offices, Stanton and Anthony once again tried an alliance. The National Labor Union, which was formed in 1866, began reaching out to farmers, African Americans, and women with the intention of forming a broad-based political party. The revolution responded enthusiastically, declaring the principles of the National Labor Union are our principles. It predicted that the producers, the working men, the women, the Negroes, are destined to form a triple power that shall speedily wrest the scepter of government from the non-producers, the land monopolists, the bondholders, and politicians. Anthony and Stanton were seated as delegates to the NLU Congress in 1868, with Anthony representing the Working Women's Association, which had recently been formed in the offices of the Revolution. The attempted alliance, however, did not last long. During a printer's strike in 1869, Anthony voiced approval of an employer-sponsored training program that would teach women the skills that would enable them to, in effect, replace the strikers. Anthony viewed the program as an opportunity to increase employment of women in a trade from which women were often excluded by both employers and unions. And at the next NLU Congress, Anthony was first seated as a delegate, but then unseated because of strong opposition from those who accused her of supporting strikebreakers. Anthony worked tirelessly with the Women's Working Women's Association to form all female labor unions, but with little success. She accomplished more in her work with the joint campaign by the Working Women's Association and the Revolution to win a pardon, however, for Hester Vaughn, a domestic worker who had been found guilty of infanticide and sentenced to death, charging that the social and legal systems treated women unfairly. The WWA organized a mass meeting at which Anthony was one of the speakers and sent delegations to visit Vaughn in prison and to speak with the governor. And eventually this led to Vaughn being pardoned. Originally with a membership that included over 100 wage-earning women, the WWA evolved into an organization consisting almost entirely of journalists, doctors, and other middle-class working women. Its members formed the core of the New York City portion of the new National Suffrage Organization that Anthony and Stanton were in the process of forming. In May of 1869, 2 days after the final AERA convention, Anthony and Stanton and others formed the National Women Suffrage Association. And in November 1869, Lucy Stone, Julia Ward Howe, and others formed the competing American Women Suffrage Association. The hostile nature of their rivalry created a partisan atmosphere that endured for decades, affecting even professional historians of the women's movement. The immediate cause for the split was the proposed 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which would prohibit the denial of suffrage because of race. Now, in one of her most controversial actions, Anthony campaigned against the amendment. She and Stanton called for women and African Americans to be enfranchised at the same time, and she meant it, damn it. They said that by effectively enfranchising all men while excluding all women, the amendment would create an aristocracy of sex by giving constitutional authority to the idea that men, no matter their race, were superior to women, no matter their race. In 1873, Anthony said an oligarchy of wealth where the rich govern the poor, an oligarchy of learning where the educated govern the ignorant, or even an oligarchy of race where the Saxon rules the African might be endured. But surely this oligarchy of sex, which makes the men of every household sovereigns, masters, the women subjects, slaves, carrying dissension, rebellion in every home of the nation, cannot be endured. Now, the AWSA supported the amendment, but Lucy Stone, who became its prominent leader, most prominent leader, I should say, also made it clear that she believed that suffrage for women would be more beneficial to the country than suffrage for black men. The two organizations had other differences as well. The NWSA was politically independent, but the AWSA was at least initially aimed for close ties with the Republican Party, hoping that the ratification of the amendment would lead a Republican push for women's suffrage. The NWSA focused primarily on winning suffrage at the national level, while the AWSA pursued a state-by-state strategy. The NWSA initially worked on a wider range of women's issues than the AWSA, including divorce reform and equal pay. Soon events removed much of the basis for the split in the movement, however. In 1870, debate about the 15th Amendment was made irrelevant when the amendment was officially ratified. In 1872, disgust with corruption in government led to a mass defection of abolitionists and other social reformers from the Republicans to the short-lived Liberal Republican Party. As early as 1875, however, Anthony began urging the NWSA to focus more exclusively, on women's suffrage rather than a variety of women's issues. The rivalry between the women's groups was so bitter, however, that a merger proved to be impossible for 20 years. The AWSA, which was especially strong in New England, was the larger of the two organizations, but it began to decline in strength during the 1880s. And in 1890, when the two organizations merged as the National American Women's Suffrage Association, otherwise known as NASA, not NASA, but NASA, it's just a fun word to say, with Stanton as president, but with Anthony as its effective leader. And when Stanton retired from her post in 1892, Anthony became NASA's president. Now, that Anthony remained unmarried gave her an important business advantage in this work. A married woman at the time had the legal status of femme couvert, which, among other things, excluded her from signing contracts. Her husband could do that for her if he chose. As Anthony had no husband, she was a femme sole and could freely sign contracts for convention halls, printed materials, etc. Using fees she earned by lecturing, she paid off the debt she had accumulated while supporting the revolution. With the press treating her as a celebrity, she proved to be a major draw. Over her career, she estimated that she averaged 75 to 100 speeches per year. That's not too shabby. Travel conditions in the earlier days were sometimes appalling. Once she gave a speech from the top of a billiard table. On another occasion, her train was snowbound for days, and she survived on crackers and dried fish. So if you were thinking, maybe she just got a fiery personality, also Susan B. Anthony was just kind of a badass in general, if you haven't picked up on that yet. Stanton joined the lecture circuit about 1870, traveling from mid-autumn to spring usually, and the timing was right because the nation was beginning to discuss women's suffrage as a serious matter. They occasionally traveled together, but most often not, as Stanton was a little bit busy with her family. A special opportunity arose in 1876 when the U.S. celebrated its 100th birthday as an independent country. The NWSA had asked permission to present a Declaration of Rights for Women at the official ceremony in Philadelphia, but was refused. Undaunted, five women headed by Anthony walked onto the platform during the ceremony and handed their declaration to the startled official in charge. As they left, They handed out copies of it to the crowd, and spotting an unoccupied bandstand outside the hall, Anthony mounted it and read the declaration out to the crowd. Afterwards, she invited everyone to a convention at the nearby Unitarian Church, where speakers like Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton awaited them. The work of all segments of the women's suffrage movement began to show clear results. Women won the right to vote in Wyoming in 1869 and in Utah in 1870. Her lectures in Washington and four other states led directly to invitations for her to address state legislatures there as well. The Grange, a large advocacy group for farmers, officially supported women's suffrage as early as 1885, and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the largest women's organization in the country, also supported suffrage. Anthony's commitment to the movement, her Spartan lifestyle, and the fact that she did not seek personal financial gain made her an effective fundraiser and won her the admiration of many who didn't even agree with her. People started to admire her and listen to her words, whether they agreed with her or not, because they saw that she was so committed to what she believed in. They admired her passion. Even her enemies started to sympathize with her. As her reputation grew, her working and travel conditions improved. She sometimes had the use of the private rail car of Jane Stanford, a sympathizer whose husband owned a major railroad. While lobbying and preparing for the annual suffrage conventions in Washington, she was provided with a free suite of rooms in the Riggs Hotel, whose owners supported her work. To ensure continuity, Anthony trained a group of younger activists who were known as her nieces to assume leadership roles within the organization. Two of them, Carrie Chapman Catt and Anna Howard Shaw, served as presidents of NASA after Anthony would retire from the position. We now reach the United States versus Susan B. Anthony. The NWSA Convention of 1871 adopted a strategy of urging women to attempt to vote, and then, after being turned away, to file suits in federal courts to challenge laws that prevented women from voting. The legal basis for the challenge would be the recently adopted 14th Amendment, part of which reads, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens in the United States." So, basically, Susan B. Anthony said, "Game on, let's do this thing. We're going to just go ahead and manipulate the laws and the language of the laws to our own advantage." And surprise, surprise, that pissed a lot of people off because it started to work. Following the example set by Anthony and her sisters shortly before Election Day, a total of nearly 50 women in Rochester registered to vote in the presidential election of 1872. On Election Day, Anthony and 14 other women from her ward convinced the election inspectors to allow them to cast ballots, but women in other wards were turned back. Anthony would later be arrested on November 18th of 1872 by a U.S. deputy marshal and charged with illegally voting. The other women who had voted were also arrested but released, pending the outcome of Anthony's trial. Anthony's trial generated a national controversy and became a major step in the transition of the broader women's rights movement into the women's suffrage movement. And let's just take a pause to admire the masterstroke that Anthony struck here, because if she didn't already gain popularity from her passion and vigor for pursuing women's rights and her just absolute machine-like pursuing of her goals, whether it was fundraising, whether it was organizing these conventions, whether it was training people to speak and teaching people, Anthony was already gaining a large amount of popularity across the country. And her opposition basically just handed her the keys to a Ferrari right here and put her on display for everyone to see and give her a platform to speak again on a national level. Now, Anthony spoke throughout Monroe County, New York, where her trial was to be held and from where the jurors for her trial would be chosen. So she's a smart cookie. She goes out and speaks about, so she gets arrested, she's going to go to trial, and before she gets to go to trial, she goes around and starts talking about women's rights and voting.
just keeps going. Her speech was entitled, "Is it a crime for a U.S. citizen to vote?" She said, "We no longer petition the legislature or Congress to give us the right to vote. We appeal to women everywhere to exercise their too long neglected citizens' right to vote." The U.S. attorney arranged for the trial to be moved to the federal circuit court, which would soon sit in neighboring Ontario County with a jury drawn from that county's inhabitants. Anthony responded by speaking throughout that county also before the trial began. So before she can go to trial again, she just goes out and gives the same speech. Responsibility for that federal circuit was in the hands of Justice Ward Hunt, who had recently been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Hunt himself had never served as a trial judge, originally a politician. He had begun his judicial career by being elected to the New York Court of Appeals. Now, the trial, United States versus Susan B. Anthony, began on June 7th of 1873, so she had plenty of time to get ready and was closely followed by the national press. Following a rule of common law at that time which prevented criminal defendants in courts from testifying, Hunt refused to allow Anthony to speak until the verdict had been delivered. Now, on the second day of the trial, after both sides had presented their cases, Justice Hunt delivered his lengthy opinion, which he had put in writing. In the most controversial aspect of the trial, Hunt directed the jury to deliver a guilty verdict. Now, on the third day of the trial, Hunt asked Anthony if she had anything to say, and she responded with the most famous speech in the history of the agitation for women's suffrage. According to one historian, Andy Gordon, now repeatedly ignoring the judge's order to stop talking and sit down, she protested what she called this high-handed outrage upon my citizens' rights, saying, "You have trampled underfoot every vital principle of our government. My natural rights, my civil rights, my political rights, my judicial rights are all alike ignored." She castigated the judge for denying her trial by jury, but said that even if he had allowed the jury to discuss the case, she still would have been denied a trial by a jury of her peers because women were not allowed to be jurors. When Hunt sentenced Anthony to pay a fine of $100, she responded, "I shall never pay a dollar of your unjust penalty," and she never did. And if Hunt had ordered her to be jailed until she paid the fine, Anthony could have taken her case to the Supreme Court. So instead, Hunt announced that he would not order her taken into custody, closing off that legal avenue. The U.S. Supreme Court in 1875 put an end to the strategy of trying to achieve women's suffrage through the court system when it ruled in Minor v. Happersett, "The Constitution of the United States does not confer the right of suffrage upon anyone." The NWSA decided to pursue the far more difficult strategy of campaigning for constitutional amendment to achieve the rights of voting for women. And ultimately, the work of Susan B. Anthony would do a great deal for this movement. Now, I do before we close things up, I want to talk about, you know, Stanton finally, you know, and the relationship here towards the end of her life, because I mentioned at the beginning of this that Susan B. Anthony and Mary Katie Stanton were incredibly close, and even though there were times when they didn't see eye to eye, they still referred to each other as friends. Now, they worked together in a close, productive relationship. From 1880 to 1886, they were together and almost every day working on the history of women's suffrage, this massive project that they were working on. They referred to each other as Susan and Miss Stanton. Anthony deferred to Stanton in other ways also, not accepting an office in any organization that would place her above Stanton. In practice, this generally meant that Anthony, although ostensibly holding a less important office, handled most of the organization's daily activities. Stanton sometimes felt the weight of Anthony's determination and drive, and when Stanton arrived at an important meeting in 1888 with her speech not yet written, Anthony insisted that Stanton stay in her hotel room until she had written it, and she placed a younger colleague outside her door to make sure she did so. At Anthony's 70th birthday celebration, Stanton teased her by saying, "Well, Oz, all women are supposed to be under the thumb of some man. I prefer a tyrant of my own sex, so I shall not deny the patent facts of my subjection." Their interests began to diverge somewhat as they grew older. As the drive for women's suffrage gained momentum, Anthony began to form alliances with more conservative groups such as the Women's Temperance Movement, Christian Temperance Union, the nation's largest women's organization, and a supporter of women's suffrage. These moves irritated Stanton, who said, "I get more radical as I get older," while she seems to grow more conservative. In 1895, Stanton published the Women's Bible, which attacked the use of the Bible to relegate women to an inferior status, and it became a highly controversial bestseller. The author voted to disavow any connection with it, despite Anthony's strong objection that such a move was unnecessary and hurtful. Even so, Anthony refused to assist with the book's preparation, telling Stanton, "You say women must be emancipated from their superstitions before enfranchisement will have any benefit, and I say just the reverse, that women must be enfranchised before they can be emancipated from their superstitions." Despite such friction, their relationship continued to be close. When Stanton died in 1902, Anthony wrote to another friend saying, "Oh, this is awful, hush. Seems impossible that voice is stilled, which I have loved to hear for 50 years. Always I have felt I must have Mrs. Stanton's opinion of things before I knew where I stood myself. I am all at sea. Having lived for years in hotels and with friends and relatives, Anthony agreed to settle into her sister Mary Stafford Anthony's house in Rochester in 1891 at the age of 71. Her energy and stamina, which sometimes exhausted her co-workers, continued at a remarkable level. At age 75, she toured Yosemite National Park on the back of a mule. She remained as the leader of NASA and continued to travel extensively on suffrage work and engaged in local projects. In 1893, she initiated the Rochester branch of the Women's Educational and Industrial Union, and in 1898, she called a meeting of 73 women societies to form Rochester's Council of Women. She played a key role in raising funds acquired by the University of Rochester before they would admit women students, and pledging her life insurance policy to close the final funding gap. In 1896, she spent 8 months on the California suffrage campaign, speaking as many as 3 times per day in more than 30 localities. In 1900, she presided over her last NASA convention. During the 6 remaining years of her life, Anthony spoke at 6 more conventions and 4 congressional hearings, completed the 4th volume of the History of Women's Suffrage, and traveled to 18 states and toured Europe. As her fame grew, some politicians, maybe not all, but some, were happy to be publicly associated with her. Her 70th birthday was celebrated at a national event in Washington with prominent members of the House and Senate in attendance, and her 80th birthday was celebrated at the White House at the invitation of President William McKinley himself. Susan B. Anthony died at the age of 86 due to heart failure and pneumonia in her home in Rochester, New York, on March 13th in the year 1906. She would be buried at Mount Hope Cemetery in Rochester, and at her birthday celebration in Washington, D.C. a few days earlier, Anthony had spoken to those who had worked with her for women's rights. There have been others also just as true and devoted to the cause. I wish I could name every one, but with such women consecrating their lives, failure is impossible. Failure is impossible quickly became a watchword for the women's movement. Now, while Anthony did not live to see the achievement of women's suffrage at the national level, pride in the progress that the women's movement had made. At the time of her death, women had achieved suffrage in Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and Idaho, as well as several other larger states would follow soon afterward. Legal rights for married women had been established in most states, and most professions had at least a few women members. 36,000 women were attending colleges and universities, up from zero only a couple decades earlier. 2 years before she died, Anthony said, "The world has never witnessed a greater revolution than in the sphere of women during this 50 years. Part of the revolution, in Anthony's view, was in ways of thinking In a speech in 1889, she noted that women had always been taught that their purpose was to serve men, but now, after 40 years of agitation, the idea is beginning to prevail that women were created for themselves, for their own happiness, and for the welfare of the world. Anthony was sure that suffrage would be achieved, but she feared that people would forget how difficult it was to achieve it, as they were already forgetting the ordeals of the recent past. We shall someday be heeded, and when we shall have our amendment to the Constitution of the U.S. government, everybody will think it was always so, just as exactly as many young people think that all the privileges, all the freedom, and all the enjoyments which women now possess always were hers. They have no idea of how every single inch of ground that she stands upon today has been gained by the hard work of some little handful of women of the past. And these are the words of Susan B. Anthony in 1894. Anthony's death was widely mourned. Clara Barton, founder of the American Red Cross, said just before Anthony's death, a few days ago, someone said to me that every woman should stand with bared head before Susan B. Anthony. Yes, I answered, and every man as well. For ages, he has been trying to carry the burden of life's responsibility alone. Just now, it is new and strange, and men cannot comprehend what it would mean, but the change is not far away. In her History of the Women's Suffrage Movement, Eleanor Flexner wrote, "If Lucretia Mott typified the moral force of the movement, if Lucy Stone was its most gifted orator, and Miss Stanton its most outstanding philosopher, Susan B. Anthony was its incomparable organizer who gave it force and direction for half a century." The 19th Amendment, which guaranteed the right of American women to vote, was colloquially known as the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. After it was ratified in 1920, the National American Women Suffrage Association, whose character and policies were strongly influenced by Anthony, was transformed into the League of Women Voters, which is still an active force today. And for those of you interested, Anthony's papers are held in library collections at Harvard University, Radcliffe Institute, as well as Rutgers University and the Library of Congress. So, guys, that brings to a close our presentation of Susan B. Anthony and what a legacy to be left behind. 50 years of activism, 50 years of activity, years of dedication to a task, a lifetime by many accounts. But in 50 years out of her 80-plus years of life, Stanton was undaunted from the age of 16 into well into her 70s. She was a pistol, one of the most fiery, passionate speakers and organizers of any movement we've ever seen in history. She earned every ounce and gained every bit of what she wanted in the end. And even though she didn't live to see her final dream realized, you gotta know, she always saw the end in sight. As I hope you enjoyed today's show, I hope you learned a lot, and I hope you enjoyed this presentation. I've been meaning to get to this for quite a while. There's so many names lost in the shuffle when we start talking about history. There's so many people who commit tremendous sacrifices, who make tremendous sacrifices of their lives for not only their country, but also for those less fortunate than themselves. And there are so many people who dedicated themselves to movements that we don't talk about enough because they're not the big names. But I guess people will argue that Susan B. Anthony is certainly a big name, but we're not going to see her talked about on a lot of more mainstream shows. You're not going to see very many presentations of her unless it's, the flavor of the month, right? Unless it's Women's History Recognition Month or something. And so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to launch this series for the show. And we're going to be doing more of these. Susan B. Anthony just felt like the one to start with for this series of women who made their mark on history. And I hope you guys enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed getting to share it with you guys. If you're looking for some more information, not only can you look at her writings digitally with the Library of Congress, but there's a number of things that have been written on her that you can take a look at. I recommend that you take a look at the work of Nellie Bly, Champion of Her Sex. Miss Susan B. Anthony tells the story of a remarkable life. This is an interview conducted with her. You want to take a look at Anna Howard Shaw's The Story of a Pioneer. You can also look at the New York Times database for articles on Susan B. Anthony as well. Take a look at Scott Wilson's Resting Places, the Burial Sites of More Than 14,000 Famous Persons for more information about her burial and how she was celebrated. I also suggest you take a look at some of the articles that she wrote herself. One titled "The Moral Leadership of the Religious Press." There's so much source material left behind for you to take a look at. So many speeches that you can see, and I do want to go ahead and to remind you all that there was a nice project done as well. The selected papers of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony is also something you want to take a look at. But the Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony project is something that you're going to want to take a look at as well. See that with multiple university presses. And then finally, here's a list of great works that you're going to want to take a look at. I recommend you take a look at Kathleen Barry's Susan B. Anthony, A Biography of a Singular Feminist. The work of Eugene B. Debs, Susan B. Anthony, Pioneer of Freedom. Ellen Carroll Du Bois, Feminism and Suffrage, The Emergence of an Independent Women's Movement in America from 1848 to 1869. Just to get a general idea of the movement itself, it's printed with Cornell University Press. Andy Gordon, The Trial of Susan B. Anthony. Elizabeth Griffiths, In Her Own Right, The Life of Elizabeth Cady Stanton as well, if you want to learn a little bit more about her and her relationship with Susan B. Anthony. And then the project with Rutgers University Press, again, I want to bring this up, The Selected Papers of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony with Rutgers University Press. There are multiple segments to it. There's In the School of Anti-Slavery from 1840 to 1866, Against an Aristocracy of Sex from 1866 to 1873, and they all have the addendum title of The Selected Papers of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. The National Protection for National Citizens, 1873 to 1880, When Clowns Make Laws for Queens, 1880 to 1887, Place Inside the Body Politic, 1887 to 1895, and An Awful Hush, 1895 to 1906. And then finally, Ida Husted Harper's The Life and Work of Susan B. Anthony in three volumes with the Hollenbeck Press. So that's all I've got for you guys today. Do take a look at that source material if you get the opportunity to do so. That project is definitely something worth your time if you're just a student of history and you want to learn something, but it's definitely worth noting that while everybody we've talked about on the show has made some indelible mark on history for the most part, say that they were able to not only change the mind of their enemy, but gain the respect of their enemy as well, like this character did. So again, I had a great time doing this show, and I'm looking forward to more of our segments in the future. I hope you guys all enjoyed it, and I hope you'll take a look at that source material and check out
that project that's preserving so many of these documents for us that we can still read and look at today. Enjoy the rest of your day, guys, and I'll see you all next week when we will actually play host to the band Castle Black, and we're going to be talking about their song, Sierra. Until then, enjoy. See you soon.